Jarrett Adams was wrongfully convicted of sexual assault in Wisconsin when he was 17. After serving nearly a decade in prison, he was exonerated and released. Jarrett was a guest on this show last year to talk about his story after it was featured in the book Exoneree Diaries, The Fight for Innocence, Independence, and Identity.
Jarrett is now an attorney with the Innocence Project in New York and focuses on issues like prison reform and wrongful convictions. Just last month, Adams made his first appearance in Wisconsin court as an attorney representing a client who says that he was wrongfully convicted of sexual assault. Jarrett Adams joins us now. Jarrett, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thank you all for having me.
Well, you have been down the road that ends in an overturned conviction yourself. Briefly, can you remind us what happened?
I was wrongfully convicted of a sexual assault, falsely accused, after a consensual encounter. And a story evolved of, me and two men sneaking up a flight of stairs and raping someone and fleeing a building. And the only problem was it wasn't true, and there were witnesses who were able to create a timeline of events that made it absolutely impossible. These were witnesses that, were never at my trial. I had a public defender assigned to me, and, at 17, 18, never being accused of being in any trouble at all, my parents and myself, we didn't know the difference between a good defense and a bad defense. The only thing I kept saying was, look, I didn't do it. It isn't true. We were there at this party the entire day, entire night, and I couldn't really think in terms of how important a timeline to events and stuff like that was. And it took a huge chunk out of my life only to be my conviction to be reversed, all the charges be dismissed, and, me to be released without a record. But, there's a 10-year gap in my resume now.
What was the process like? I mean, 10 years is a big chunk of time, as you just said. Do you remember clearly what it was like going through those 10 years to get to the eventual overturned conviction?
Yeah, it was an evolution process. I mean, I got the opportunity to see, at first I thought, this is just a black and white thing. I had a white accuser, and I felt like, my case was completely overshadowed with the racial undertones. And I felt like going into prison, it was all about race. But I quickly realized that, the criminal justice system doesn't discriminate by color. It discriminates by resources. And it's a bottom feeder of those who can't afford to get a defense or don't even know what a defense is. I met so many people while in prison who were there because they pled guilty or were either found guilty, not because they were guilty, but because they couldn't afford an adequate defense.
Obviously, you're a lawyer now. You know exactly what you're talking about. You understand the difference between a good defense and a bad defense. But when did you decide that you had an affinity for the law and that you were going to pursue it, even if from behind bars?
I mean, if I can get the listeners to see the pain and anguish etched across my mother's forehead in the visiting room, I think that would be enough to get anyone over whatever hump it is in front of them that they say they can't get over. I was inspired, by her strength to continue to support me and drive, so many miles to come and see me in these prisons, which are often, upstate and away from society itself. And so I left in debt. And I told myself that, when she goes to church, now that I'm out, she won't look down and cry anymore. And if there are tears, it would be tears of joy. So I started to work, went to school, and I was able to do this. And she made me promise her that I didn't just go off into the sunset with a career and aspirations to make money, but I practiced law and leave behind a legacy of helping others who were just like the situation that me and her was in.
How old were you when you got out?
I was 26 and I was turning 27 years old. So, at 17, turning 18, arrested. And I was, all my other friends were going off and going to college. And they were sending letters and showing me pictures of their first cars. I was in prison with a mandatory release of 2019 for a rape case that had absolutely no evidence besides an allegation. And, when I got out, I just felt like, so much time had been missed. There was no way I was going to be able to make that time back up. And even the process when I got out was extremely difficult. And it took me a while before I realized that I needed therapy and I needed help. I needed to talk to someone and released all of my anger and frustration to allow me to turn that anger and frustration into the fuel that drove me to where I am today.
Do you think that the resources are there, including, as you said, mental health counseling, financial aid? Are those there for other people like yourself?
It has to be. And the reason that I say that it has to be is because what we are doing in society is this. Most of the people who go to prison, they're coming home someday, right? So we're basically, as taxpayers, we're investing so much money to warehouse people instead of correcting them. And when we warehouse them for decades at a time and we release them, we're releasing them where? Right back into our community. So it would behoove us in society to figure out a way to find the necessary funds to make sure that the people that we are sending to prison are really getting the resources they need to correct themselves, because it's not happening at all.
What do you think about the amount of financial compensation people who have been found to be wrongfully convicted get? There's been a lot of focus on this in the past several years, saying that what a lot of states have set aside for someone who's released after being wrongfully convicted is not enough to restart a life. What do you say?
I mean, it's definitely not. And I would say this. When we think in terms of compensation, we need to stop thinking in terms of monetary compensation, because the most important compensation a person can have is physical and mental health care once they come home. Prisons aren't country yards. Like nothing great happens in prison at all. And even if you aren't attacked or anything like that, you can't erase what your eyes see. And it takes a psychological toll and effect on the person. And what happens with that person when they come home? Well, you got to ask your question, what is home? And home is not your home, because you've been locked up for so long. So a family member, you may be fortunate to have a family member who allows you to come into their home and make it your home. But at the same time, that burden falls on that family as well. And so, it's a holistic approach that needs to be taken with the criminal justice system. I think that in society, we've allowed ourselves to believe that every time a person is accused or walks across the screen with a pair of handcuffs on, we don't ask ourselves, what is he accused of? We immediately say, what did he do?
We're talking with Jared Adams right now. He was wrongfully convicted of sexual assault in Wisconsin when he was 17 years old. After serving nearly a decade in prison, he was exonerated. He's now an attorney with the Innocence Project in New York and focuses on issues like prison reform and wrongful convictions. And right now, you're representing a Wisconsin man who says he was wrongfully convicted of a sexual assault. Can you tell us about that case?
Well, this is another case where, all the hallmarks are there when you look at these cases where the justice system can get it wrong. Richard Berenick was accused of a crime while he had six alibi witnesses who showed that he was in a different state. He was nowhere near the state of Wisconsin. He was in West Virginia, I believe, somewhere at the time of this assault. Not only did he have the six witnesses to show that he was in that state, he also applied for food stamps while staying with his sister. He was struggling to find work in Wisconsin. His mother put him on a bus to go to live with his sister for a few months to find work, because her husband was a construction guy, and he was able to provide him some work. So while there, she told Richard, she says, look, there's a lot of mouths to feed in this house, so we need to get you on food stamps. They applied for food stamps, and luckily they kept the receipt of that. So we had that, along with the six witnesses, at his trial. And it still wasn't enough to go against the state's witness, who produced a federal agent who stood before the jury and said that a hair found at the scene had similarities to a hair of Richard. Decades later, we found out that science was junk, and the FBI issued an order and told the federal agents who testified to stop testifying in this manner. So now that brings us forward all the way to right now, where not only did we have the junk science of the evidence influence the jury's outcome, but now we've been able to test these hairs in the case. And these hairs exclude Richard Berenick from being at the scene of this crime. And so now we have that. We have already what we had before, the six witnesses, and we have the FBI agent's testimony we know was false. And so here we are, and we have to fight tooth and nail to just get him in front of a jury again to hear this evidence.
So what happens next in that case?
I mean, we are basically in a briefing period right now. We have presented the expert witnesses who were able to testify to what they did as far as the testing goes. And now we're briefing, we're briefing little issues concerning, in my opinion, it's just really concerning chain of custody. So right now the argument isn't the results. No one is arguing the results that exclude Mr. Brennan. Right now we're arguing about well, who touched this evidence? Where did it go from there? Well, who was the mailman who delivered it? So it's just absolutely ridiculous what we're doing right now. And each day that goes past is an innocent man not only being in prison, but if this woman was raped as she claims that she was, well, then we have someone who raped the lady that is still roaming free right now in the community.
And, Jared, just briefly, we're just about out of time, but you're working alongside Wisconsin Innocence Project co-founder Keith Finley, who represented you in your wrongful conviction case. What is it like to have come full circle like that?
Yeah, I mean, it's surreal, just getting the opportunity to sit next to Keith. When I heard him argue my case in the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, I was actually in handcuffs inside of a room listening to a phone on the wall as he argued my case and advocated for my innocence and to overturn my conviction. And, you know, here it is. It's 10 years later to the month that I was released, and I am practicing law besides him. And so it's a very surreal feeling, but it's also an inspiring feeling, I hope, to not just, you know, those who are close to me, but others who are listening as well, to understand that there will always be obstacles in life. We have to either go around, go over, or go right through them.
And, Jared, we leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us. Jared Adams there. He's an attorney now. He was wrongfully convicted of sexual assault in Wisconsin when he was 17.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.